Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Biles, recorded in our writer's studio just above the bookshop at Kilometre Zero in Paris. If you enjoy these conversations, there are a few different ways you can support us. First of all, you can leave a rating right now in whatever podcast app you're using. The more ratings we get, the more likely it is that people will discover us. It only takes a few seconds and can really help spread the word. You can also buy books, gifts, and apparel from our online store, shakespeareandcompany.com, where you'll find our popular Year of Reading subscription, 12 books handpicked by our dedicated booksellers, shipped to you or a loved one wherever they are in the world. Finally, you can become a friend of Shakespeare & Company by joining the association we set up to get us through a difficult few years. Membership gives you access to exclusive online content, as well as other treats depending on the tier you choose. Find out more at friendsofshakespeareandcompany.com. I'll be back at the end, but until then, sit back and enjoy the Shakespeare & Company podcast. Today, I'm joined by two poets who, in their latest works, embark upon extraordinary formal experiments through which, perhaps somewhat paradoxically, they succeed in delivering two of the most accessible, moving, and profound collections, if that's the word for these remarkable books, that I've read this year. Richard Barnett's Wherever We Are When We Come to the End is an imagining of the experience of the young Ludwig Wittgenstein in the First World War, recounted in the same austere and succinct statements as the philosopher's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, the initial notes for which were taken during the conflict. The result is an affecting examination of love, duty, and violence that had such a strong impact on me that it sent me back to investigate Wittgenstein's writings with fresh eyes. Sarah Bakewell called Wherever We Are When We Come to the End ingenious, devastating, and filled with emotional riches. Luke Kennard's Notes on the Sonnets revisit Shakespeare's poetry in a chain of prose poems set in a British house party. The party is a contradictory beast, at once crushingly dull yet flecked with the absurd, at once sprawling yet intensely claustrophobic. Kennard's poems embody these contradictions too. They somehow manage to be superficial yet profound, charmingly insolent yet glacially serious, knowingly pretentious yet deeply insecure and self-critical, and they take in almost every subject under the stars. Notes on the Sonnets was a Poetry Book Society recommendation and recently won the Forward Prize for Best Collection 2021. Richard, Luke, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Thank you. Good to be
Thanks.
Here.
Richard, beginning with you, ever since Ludwig Wittgenstein died more than, seven decades ago now, he seems to have provided an enormous inspiration to artists, particularly writers, but other artists too, sort of across the board. I'm just curious to begin, would you be able to reflect a little bit on what it was about the man or his work that appeals so much to artists?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I can tell a sort of general story here, and I can tell my own specific story. The general story is very well told in Marjorie Perloff's wonderful book, Wittgenstein's Ladder, which was really the first book to sort of think about the Tractatus and his other writings from a kind of aesthetic perspective, kind of recasting them as forms of literature, especially forms of modernist literature. And I think part of the appeal is that it does. This is where, as it were, the general story intersects with my own personal story. That I think if you come to the Tractatus without preconceptions, as I did when I was a late teenager, this whole book goes back to a completely chance encounter in the school library when I was about 17. If you just pick up this book and read it, there's something that as I said in an interview recently, it kind of smells like a poem. Obviously, it isn't. I had an argument with the British Wittgenstein Society recently about, you know, is it literally a poem or not? And of course, no, it's literally a work of philosophy. But it feels like a poem. It's concerned with all of the things that modernism was concerned about. It's concerned with language and the limits of language. It's crucially concerned with what kind of lies beyond those limits, what lies beyond speech and beyond death. It's concerned, rather brilliantly, it's concerned with nonsense. Nonsense is a kind of key term in the early Wittgenstein's philosophy. And structurally as well, that was the thing that really grabbed him was. If listeners to this haven't seen the book before, quickly Google Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus and have a look at how it looks on the page. It's this extraordinary book. I don't really think there's anything else like it in, not only in philosophy, but really in literature. It consists of a series of numbered propositions. And it's, as you might expect, starts with number one. But the second proposition is 1.1, which is the first comment on proposition one. 1.2 is the second comment on proposition one. 1.21 is the first comment on the second sub-comment, and so on and so on. It's a lot harder to discuss and to explain than it is actually to just see it on the page. And even at 17, I looked at this and I thought, well, this is a poetic structure. You can use this. Wittgenstein does to create, as it were, sort of stanzas and clauses and sections you can use it to kind of create this kind of cycling structure of allusions that run right through the book. So I think in lots of ways, Wittgenstein said towards the end of his life that philosophy should be written in a poetic style, in a poetic method. And I think that's mm-hmm. part of the reason why it's so appealing. It has, as Marjorie Perloff said, that sense of mystery, that sense of irresolution that characterizes so much good poetry.
Mm. And I think that's definitely was my experience as well when I first came across the Tractatus, which was a few years older than you. I guess I was in my second year of university. And one of the things that appealed to me about it was the fact it seemed to stand alone, stand independent from any other work of philosophy. You didn't need any background to engage with it. You didn't need any particular knowledge of any other strand of philosophy or previous philosophers who come before. And there was something about that sort of that isolation in a way that that set it apart for me.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's a universe all of its own, and that's really what it's trying to be. It's also possibly the most ambitious poetry book ever written, in that it really is trying to solve all of the problems in philosophy. Wittgenstein says right at the end that if you've understood this book, you can, as he says, you can climb up the ladder and throw the ladder away. You don't even need the book in some ways once you've absorbed the book. A word that's often used, Terry Eagleton used this word in his unfilmed screenplay for Jarman's Wittgenstein. It's very crystalline. It has, on the one hand, it is utterly impenetrable in parts. I've now spent 20 years thinking about this book, and there are lines, but I have no fucking idea what he's talking about. Oh, sorry, I should ask, is it okay to curse, by the way, once in a while? I'm not a very sweary person, but great. Good. Yes, you know, there are passages that seem absolutely beautiful and like some of the best lines in English poetry, you know, whereof we cannot speak, we must pass over in silence, the world is all that is the case, and so on and so on. But there are other lines that are just extraordinarily difficult and opaque. So part of what led me to write about it in the particular way that I did was then to connect this, as you say, this strange sense of this crystalline universe all to itself, this thing that's like some beautiful Fabergé egg that's at once kind of fragile, but on the other hand, kind of astonishingly kind of hard and permanent, with the circumstances in which it was written. Right. This was really how I came to write the book. I encountered the Tractatus when I was about 17. About a decade later, I read Ray Monk's extraordinary biography. Even if you have no interest in philosophy, it's well worth reading The Duty of Genius. It is the most extraordinary, deep, rich biography of any 20th century figure. And Monk makes the point that this book was shaped so strongly. Indeed, much of it was written in the trenches of the Eastern Front during the First World War. And not even on the front line, Wittgenstein volunteered for what was just about the most dangerous job in the whole First World War, which was to be a forward artillery observer. So he's in front of the front line, trying to direct his own Austro-Hungarian shells falling on the enemy, trying to dodge the enemy, who, of course, are desperately trying to put him out of action. And what struck me as extraordinary is really two things. Firstly, when he talks about this later in his life, he talks about the peace of it. He seems to have found this extraordinary clarity and almost this sense of eternity and immortality in what for almost anybody else would be this violent, appalling, traumatic, deathly struggle. I think it was late 30s, he writes a letter to his nephew and almost offhandedly says in this letter, "The war saved me. I don't know what I'd have done without it." And that became one of the epigraphs of the book, because growing up as I did sort of in England in the 80s, I learned about the First World War and to some extent about English poetry through reading Sassoon and Owen and the war poets. Mm-hmm. And you get a very particular take on what the war was like. The really important move, the kind of central move of the English war poets is disillusionment. They go off to war thinking it's going to be a kind of honourable patriotic struggle. And what they discover is, you know, mud, blood, devastation and so on. And not that that's wrong, but I loved the way that Wittgenstein's line offered a different take on the war, that the war could mean different things to everybody who fought in it. And you know, for him, it really becomes it becomes this place where he encounters meaning and mortality and kind of works out what he's for, if you like. It gives him this sense of duty, not just military duty, but kind of personal duty that carries him through the rest of his life. Five point five. What is the distance, O Lord, between one moment and another? God says, "Who speaks? Why is there something here when there should be nothing?" 5.51. Faith in the action, not the word, the body, not the breath. To fall is to break, to speak, 5.52. Lanterns in the dark, the rivers up, the skull of the moon, impact polished, flesh unsoftened, a column of horses, silent, muscled, heads bowed like penitents. They've broken through. Lemberg, though, is still in our hands. 5.6. The limits of my language mean the limits of my world, and the limit of my world is the road. 5.61. The road is all that is the case. Going on is all that is. The howl of spent flesh is all. The banality of pain, its emptiness. 5.62. Happiness depends upon my realizing the limits of the sense of the world. The sense of the world must lie outside the world. No sense within, babbling into the dark like a child. 5.7. We are children. We do not know whether the sun will rise tomorrow. Is there comfort in this proposition, or sense? 5.71. Logic must take care of itself. God will not say, "What kept you?" 5.711. I am a compound noun in a picture book alphabet. Ludwig Saddlerein's Horseshoes Road. I ride a rocking horse. I wave a wooden sword. I triumph in my nursery. 5.712. A child knows how to go on. 5.72. A stone, the body of a beast, the body of a man, my body, all stand on the same level. My soul is my center of gravity and no more. God says, you will keep on, whether you want to or not, until you fall, whether you want to or not. This night more are trampled than picked off. You cowards, stand and fight for your emperor. 5.8. They know how to go on. Stepping out of their rags, grinning, they join the retreat. 5.81. Some march with us, some watch, some shuddered into monstrous forms, some cuddled up as if asleep. 5.811. The salivation of dead things, salvation rather. The discourse of the dead, their squeaks, their intolerable dance. 5.812. The equal self, unpicked, bone bare, the name and nothing else, or not even that. 5.813. Paused in resurrection, palms out, gaping, we wait on them. Franz Josef ist tot. Lemberg, though, is still in our hands. 5.82. Our emperor leads us. 5.821. His whiskers tickle lipless teeth, his medals clink on ribs, he is master of the men who cannot bleed. 5.822. Fräulein tot on her pony, demure and hollow-hipped, raw sockets behind her fan, sloppy trombones, Jew's harp, bass drum. 5.823. We fall in after them. We know how to go on. We scream with joy. 5.9. The world of the happy is quite another than that of the unhappy.
I'd like to pick up on that, because to me there seems almost a little sort of contradiction in the sort of what the way we encounter the Tractatus and Wittgenstein almost as a character, because I remember having the same sort of profound experience when reading Ray Monk's biography of being struck by what an incredibly, I suppose, strange and charismatic and unusual personality Ludwig Wittgenstein was. Like, one might be forgiven for reading the Tractatus, probably less so when reading his later works, but particularly the Tractatus, of imagining a kind of Kantian sort of, you know, guy who lived isolated all of his life, did the same walk every day for 40 years, never really engaged with people, etc., etc. Whereas, in fact, Wittgenstein, he was very much in the world. He was very much kind of engaged, not just with the realm of ideas, but with the physical experience.
Yeah, he was, by all accounts, I mean, charisma is always the hardest thing for any kind of historian or biographer to capture, but by all accounts, he was the most intensely charismatic teacher and friend and enemy as well, of course, to so many of his contemporaries. And there's a lovely line again later in his correspondence where he says that he likes to take a business-like approach to philosophy. He doesn't want to sort of swim in philosophy. He wants a sort of business desk and an in-tray and an out-tray, and he wants to solve problems and move on and go and do something else. Philosophy for him is not a life or a lifestyle or, God help him, a profession or a discipline. It's a way of kind of clearing out the undergrowth so that you can get on with whatever the hell you want to get on with. And I think that resonated very strongly with another fact from the Munk biography I was very struck with is that quite early in the war, he has a religious crisis. Mm-hmm. He encounters Tolstoy's The Gospel in Brief in a bookshop at a railway station. He's passing through the town. He just needs something to read. And it's Tolstoy's kind of attempt to strip back the gospel and to mm-hmm. almost turn the gospel into a kind of philosophical tract. He sort of cuts out what he sees as all the ephemera of the gospel and just leaves what he sees as the kind of philosophical and religious truth. And Wittgenstein becomes, certainly for the rest of the war and for some time afterwards, a kind of Tolstoyan Christian. Mm-hmm. And that led me into thinking about him as a holy fool, which mm-hmm. just what you were saying about him, I think that's another way of kind of putting the same thing. He becomes someone like Bernard of Clairvaux, or I think better mm-hmm. still, St. Francis of Assisi. This kind of wanderer, if you like, this man who attracts disciples, this man who is able to kind of approach the universe from an angle that nobody ever really has before, mm-hmm. and to say, you know, things that might seem utterly meaningless to one person, but to seem kind of deeply meaningful and profound to another. So I absolutely know what you mean. There's a sort of discipleship that comes with reading him. And I certainly for a long time fell into that myself. Mm.
And just to engage with the poem itself. And I said in the introduction, I referred to both of your books as collections, but then it didn't feel quite the right word for for either of them. And I think we'll come on to that later, because I suppose in a sense, your book is it's a poem rather than a collection.
Yeah, I think of it as a long poem. Mm. I mean, to be honest, I don't really care how people talk about it. I care if they buy it and read it. But I think of it as a kind of long poem modelled in the way that modelled after the Tractatus, that is, as it were. This is a slightly pretentious way to put it, but it's like one long jazz solo. You know, it's one long piece, as it were, like Ashbery or somebody like that. It's one long thing. And within that, we've talked already about the kind of the crystalline formality mm-hmm. of the Tractatus. It really is, as I've said, kind of one long a piece of music or something mm-hmm. like that. And of course, being a slightly sort of cranky, I don't want to say postmodernist, but kind of after-modernist poet, if you like, mm-hmm. what I immediately wanted to do was to hit it with a hammer and break up this beauty and fragment it and shatter it and bring in other voices. And again, the impenetrability of the poem here became really useful, because mm-hmm. once you start thinking about the war, especially that, I mean, good Lord, the chaos of the Eastern Front. Mm. We in Western Europe, I think in the kind of Anglophone world, we have no idea about that part of the First World War. And it was extraordinarily destructive and mm-hmm. traumatic for those who went through it. I mean, in many ways, I think kind of lays the groundwork for the appalling history of Eastern Europe in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. But the impenetrability of the Tractatus became a way to kind of capture that aspect of military life.
Yeah.
You know, orders sort of bellowed across a sort of battlefield where shells are flying. All the, you know, the Austro-Hungarian army was a polyglot army. Mm-hmm. It was composed of all sorts of different ethnicities and peoples and nations. I don't think the troops would have necessarily expected to understand one another. Yeah, so that became a way to kind of draw out the sort of the chaos and the fragmentary nature of his experience. And I, you know, in some ways, the most powerful thing he did with this book, which is from that extraordinarily traumatic fragmentary experience, draw this beautiful crystalline sort of temple of a book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One thing you talk about sort of breaking apart the form, and yet one thing that struck me, at least the way that the poem is essentially bookended, is that, I mean, you begin with the line, "Silence is not the end of it," which is, of course, if people know the Tractatus, echoing the final line of the Tractatus, and at the end of the poem, you echo the start of the Tractatus. And my thought when sort of, you know, approaching it, and I say from a kind of a non-poetic perspective, was that perhaps what you were doing with it was in some way sort of inverting the text of the Tractatus, sort of perhaps showing readers kind of the underside of what Wittgenstein was doing. Does that sound like a fair?
I've sort of been waiting for somebody to notice that. So thank you very much. No, that's exactly what I do. Partly what it was. I was very being a young idiot. I read Finnegan's Wake all the way through, and I was very struck by the way that that book becomes a kind of loop. You know, you can literally. Sure. I think Joyce even talked about having it bound without a front cover and a back cover, so it's just a loop of pages going around, and you can sort of get to the end and just start again. God, which is a certain vision of hell, of course, being trapped in Finnegan's Wake. But it was partly that I like loops. I like structure. I like all those kind of modernist techniques, but no, absolutely. I wanted. Well, you've already said it very well, to be honest. So I should just say yes. That's exactly what I was trying to do. But yes, I wanted to take the Tractatus and kind of show the working a bit, kind of pull down the facade and kind of show the bricks and the mechanism and all that behind it.
Turning to you, Luke, on the subject of kind of iconoclasm, I guess there are fewer more sort of iconic poets to engage with in the English language than Shakespeare. And when I saw the book Notes on the Sonnet, I know your work a little bit by now, so I wasn't expecting an obvious response to, a straightforward engagement with Shakespeare's work. But I certainly wasn't expecting what we got. So would you be able to just talk a little bit about the origins of this project, like how the engagement with Shakespeare's sonnets within the context of a sort of sprawling house party first kind of took root with you?
Yeah, I've just been taking loads of notes. Thank you for that, Richard. Something that you said a moment ago about coming to a text without preconceptions really resonated with me, I suppose, in terms of just going back to the sonnets and just trying to read them, I suppose read them as if they were one long poem, mm-hmm. and immerse myself in some of the critical material surrounding them, but not getting too used to mining that for any little interesting details, but not getting too bogged down in the arguments around who is the second person in various different sequences of the. I find that rather uninteresting in a way, and what I find more interesting is just the general thirst and emotional incontinence of the speaker, who is consistent throughout the poems, and that we tend to see them as great love poems, and more often it's a really troubling and problematic kind of love that's being discussed. It's often its possessiveness and jealousy and a great self-consciousness about how the speaker has no right to be feeling this way, say, about two people he was having an affair with taking up with each other and then feeling extremely jealous of both of them. And you know, the emotions that are often described are ambivalent and contradictory and self-destructive and just plain stupid sometimes as well. And I think just reading them for that was enjoyable. The setting at the house party, I guess I've been thinking about that quite a lot. And what I mean, it literally started the first poem. The narrator claims to have met somebody at a party who says that he can recite any one of the sonnets from memory if you just give him the number. Mm. But then he gives him the number 66 and the man refuses to recite 66, so either he's just lying, but then he gives him another number and he can just rattle it off, which did not actually happen to me. But I was at a party, maybe it was the merging of maybe three different parties, but there was one where everybody was taking cocaine and I found the whole experience very alienating. most people are kind of, we're mostly full of ourselves enough, I think. And it just doesn't really suit me. It's a bit of a busman's holiday for me as a drug. This commingling of various different parties. I think also just the sonnets themselves, the 154 sonnets, are actually quite a crowded space. So you've got this sort of idea of the lyric poem as this ultimate apotheosis of self-description and definition storytelling about oneself, but actually there's a sort of crowd of voices and extreme worry and paranoia about what other people think of you that comes through in the sonnets. And there was something for me in just creating that collective space and putting the lyric in this polyphonic collective space that just felt exciting in itself, just as an exercise. But it just started out as a sort of one-off poem on Sonnet 66 with the anecdote about the man who claims he has memorized all of Shakespeare's sonnets. And then I just did a few more and kept the setting kind of consistent. You know, sometimes the poem's very clearly in different rooms at the party or in kind of rooms that you're not supposed to be in somebody else's house and things like that. And some of them less so. Some of them are just in the narrator's head or just recounting some dreams and things like that. They always take off from a particular image or idea within one of the sonnets. And they're all kind of tortured love poems in one way or another. And I think part of my thinking was that I wanted it to be the sonnets, but reconfigured by a fool, essentially, right? Which I think at times is sort of the case in the sonnets already, but I wanted to really put that first and foremost. And you've really eloquently talked about the contradictions, I think, in the book and probably just in my work generally, sort of at times quite self-assured, but mostly self-cannibalistically doubtful. But then in the original sonnets, there are all of these systems of knowledge and interpretation, things just being turned around to various different angles. And well, let's look at this from a medical point of view. Let's see if any of the metaphors for how I feel about you will make sense in that context. And obviously now all of these, especially the medical ones, are all completely obsolete, mm-hmm. as are various other ways of thinking within the sonnets. But I guess I felt that, and all the sort of magical thinking, but then a lot of those superstitions and ways of magical thinking are still very much with us, mm-hmm. even if we don't believe in, say, the humours anymore. We have plenty of other things that have come up in place of that. And our ways of actually living, often sort of without reason, still feel quite pertinent to a lot of the sort of damaged thinking within mm-hmm. within the sonnets. This maybe goes back to the kind of iconoclasm as well, in that they are mostly quite insolent. I felt particularly with the really well-known sonnets, like Let Me Not to the Marriage of True Minds and Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day, that they had to be particularly anti-poetic, my responses to those. In some of them I was freer to be a little bit more sincere or lyrical, but with the really beautiful sonnets, the really amazing pieces of work, that was where I had to be really aggressively unpoetic.
Yeah. There's a lot what you said that I'd like to unpick, but can we just come back to this idea of the party? Because the one thing that it put me in mind of is quite a little known book, at least little known, I think, in the Anglophone world. But in French, the title is La Grande Beuverie, by a writer called René Daumal, who was he came out sort of the surrealists and sort of a little bit connected to the kind of the pataphysical movement of Alfred Jarry. And it is in English, it's available, I think, as A Night of Serious Drinking, which doesn't quite do the title justice, but it's very difficult to get Beuverie in English. But one thing that starts in a kind of a bar, and there are people all around, and there's the narrator overhears conversations, and then it kind of moves to different rooms. I think he goes through a trapdoor at one moment into these sort of imaginary kind of imaginary, but also very kind of embodied, very kind of physical spaces, and he's able to kind of explore ideas and sentiments within this kind of defined physical space, even if that is then stretched and played with and kind of undermined. And I felt you were doing a very sort of similar thing, that it felt that in a way having the context of the house party and the different rooms and the type of people one might meet and the drugs or the alcohol that's being consumed gave you almost a foil against which to offset your engagement with the poems.
That's really good. Yeah, definitely that. And I think it allowed me to just merge different spaces, real and imaginary spaces. Mm. There are moments, small moments of kind of autobiography, I guess. Like there was a party I was at where I was just about to order a taxi back to my hotel and then saw the logo of the hotel reflected in my glass and realised that the flat I'd ended up in was right next to the travel lodge or whatever it is that I booked a room in, and that I needed only to leap off the balcony and I'd be in my hotel room. But then I think that, there are times where it feels like, I think that sort of struck me as a really nice circular thing. And it's like, am I trapped in some kind of horrible underworld of constant house parties? And I thought that's quite a nice pattern for this sequence. And it sort of seems to be sort of, I think in throughout all of the poems, there's a certain progression of time, but it almost feels like it's just permanently 2 a.m. Mm. It's permanently the point where the party is either in full swing or it's starting to dissipate. People are either at their very best and most honest and their truest selves, or they are actually completely intoxicated and talking nonsense. Mm-hmm. So that relationship between meaninglessness and meaning was what I really wanted to play with. And it's also one where you can just be rather sly and just smuggle in some quite sincere reflections on theology and one's own kind of crises of faith or troubled thinking about faith and that sort of thing. And you can kind of get away with that because, like, in the same way that a fool can, you know. So like the fools in Shakespeare, I mean, I just love all of the fool characters in Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. One I often come back to is, was it Thersites or something in Troilus and Cressida, who is one of the most perceptive, I guess, characters in the play, in his relationship to Achilles. And just, I don't know, the fact that you can you can smuggle in some quite sincere expressions of things that are really bugging you, and sort of, and I think I always like poems where you can see the thinking happening on the page. I like poems that feel almost unfinished in that way, and that's what really gets me going. That's what makes me feel like writing, and what makes me feel like just engaging with the world and with literature again. And so there's something in that ambivalent position where you can be sort of attempting to be funny and deadly serious at the same time, but that seemed to go with the slightly hyper real settings, various settings. That some of it is almost like, I mean, some of it is almost like observational comedy. I think it's sort of lowest, the most sort of demotic parts of the book. It's just like, oh, do you know when you're at a party and somebody does this or someone says this? You know, some of it is really basic, but being able to mingle that with all of the different systems of understanding that kind of come through in the sonnets, and being able to riff on those, and being able to just do some light research into them at times, and that just felt like a helpful construct for me. It felt like a helpful thing, I suppose, like Richard was saying, about having this form and this text that you are constantly in love with and at war with. It's really sustaining. And this was meant to just be a side project, right? When I started it out, I wasn't really thinking of doing all of them. I just got rather carried away. And I was supposed to be working on a book about Jonah, the Old Testament prophet, and ended up just putting that aside completely and just working on this, and just trying to write sort of one a day and then go back. I think by the end, and I pictured it as like a giant pamphlet. That was my plan for this. I was going to go and talk to some weird little arty presses and just say, can you do a book that is incredibly cheap, but about 200 pages long on just like the worst quality paper so that I can sell it for like £1 or something like that? You know, can you do that? Because these are real. This is really, at that time, I was like, these are just little improvisations and they may be completely worthless, but there are bits of them that I like and I still like it to be out there. And then I just mentioned to Tom Chivers at Penned in the Margins that I was working this, right, send it to me, let me at least have a look at it. And he felt like it had potential. And he was like, this is good. About half of them are okay. And about half of them, I think you just need to have another run at. So I kind of did. But again, it still felt kind of loose and improvisatory. And it was only in the final edits that I was able to go back through and say, right, so what's the through line here? What can I kind of layer into the poems that isn't currently there? What's the potential with this? I like that stage of editing. I like that point where it's like, okay, what have I got here? I've just splurged a load of stuff down onto the page, and like, what can actually be done to it to shape it a bit more and actually make it a bit more involved and give people something to play with and struggle with in that in that low-grade Finnegan's Wake kind of way. Nothing like as ambitious as that, but like that thing that you want to give people something to puzzle over, I guess. You want to give people, at least imply that it's worth struggling over, right? This is based on Sonnet 6, which in the original has the lines, that's for thyself to breed another thee, or 10 times happier, be it 10 for 1, 10 times thyself were happier than thou art, if 10 of thine 10 times refigured thee. Sonnet 6. I had a dream that there were 10 of you, and we lived in a duplex overlooking the river. It was the only nice part of town. I wanted to make 10 of you happy, but it was difficult, and mostly I felt like I was letting at least 8 of you down. Even though the 10 of you were exactly you and exactly the same, you cannot stroke 10 people's hair and tell them they are good, they are so good. And oh, the divergent seconds where lived experience changed you. Even the inanities. I love what you've done to your hair. Is that a new top? Could you just shift over a little? I didn't think I was up to the job. So this is a job for you. I don't want to make any special claims here. Nobody ever walked down to a river without at least considering taking a dive. We only owned 9 mugs, for instance. And it only struck me years later, snow fishing in a void I'd learned to wrap around myself, how easy it would have been for me to do something about that. But this one comes from Sonnet 29. when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes. I have lost one of my shoes. All that follows is spoken by a man wearing one shoe. You seemed very comfortable with a brain surgeon. She's a neuroscientist. Whatever. We're just friends. I was lonely. Her clothes were very smooth. You make a cocktail and call it amygdala hijack. Oh, poor me, poor you. Observers of our own predicament. Lads on tour chanting, God will forgive us. How far you can fall in everybody's estimation is proportional to the silent claims you always made on them. Nonetheless, I think of you and wouldn't change place with anyone. Lying is one of the most sophisticated operations of the prefrontal cortex. The liar paradox is only unresolvable in languages which are semantically closed. We needn't moralise. In the end, to lie is to choose a meaningless universe. No one's saying it's easy to be honourable, but if you're not, you find yourself in uncharted territory, and it's scary. It's scary, man. I am saying this on stage at a book festival to the six people in the audience. They are looking at me like a sell-by date. Does cream of tartar even go off? You can't change anything once it's published. Afterwards, I sign one book. The man tells me to make it out to myself and to rewrite it to include this scene. On the 3-hour drive home, the clutch feels deep and chewy under my bare foot. An M40 diversion ejects me like a bad idea, and I end up going round in circles in the Vale of Evesham until I run out of petrol outside a walled garden. I can see lanterns. I can hear a string quartet.
And this is a question, I guess, which we'll bring Richard back in for this as well, because, I have to stress, you know, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a novelist rather than a poet, and of somebody who has a sort of a guilty lack of engagement with a lot of contemporary poetry. Like, I always feel I should be reading more than I do. And I think sort of somebody who doesn't read a lot of poetry might pick up both of your books and be surprised that these books are called poetry. I mean, obviously, Richard, your book, sort of the text resembles the Tractatus, which we have said resembles a poem in certain ways, but is structured like a philosophical text. Luke, yours is essentially paragraphs of look like prose on the page. And so if you forgive the sort of what I'm sure is a very sort of ignorant question, I'd be interested to hear what both of you think it is about these books that make them poetry rather than something else.
Oh, good Lord. Luke's been talking for a while, so I'll give him a break. This goes back to that whole Marcel Duchamp argument, isn't it? Doesn't it really? And I mean, it is poetry because we are poets and we say that they're poems. If I'm speaking personally, there's a certain kind of musical rhythmicality about the lines that characterizes poetry for me, but then you find that in a lot of prose as well. It's attention paid to structure, but again, you find that in a lot of prose. I really sort of don't feel qualified, and in a certain way, I'm not interested in answering that question. You know, I sort of want to put this out there as poetry and see what people say about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the healthiest position possible, really. You know, like I go back to Baudelaire's Petit Poems on Prose. Forgive my complete lack of any sort of pronunciation, but Francis Scarfe's translations of those I really love, and the parallel text of that, even though I have so little French, tragically, to my own shame. But it's really lovely to read them in parallel. But those pieces, those prose poems, and Baudelaire was perhaps the first one to really try to define what a prose poem was. And some of them are, I mean, they're all just sort of miniatures, really, the sort of thing that in other cultures and countries would have just been called a fragment or a miniature or just text, you know. And it's, but he sort of put his neck on the line and was deliberately provocative enough to say these are poems. And some of them are 13 pages long and have dialogue and are just little anecdotes, usually in which the narrator behaves obscenely or cruelly, and often with some intention of highlighting a kind of hypocrisy in 19th century Paris of one kind or another. I suppose that was always quite a big, because they're so grouchy and funny and strange, and the little observations within them are often quite perverse but sort of ring true. I think reading those at a reasonably formative age at university was quite an influence on me, and maybe also just removed any anxiety about form. Mm-hmm. There are some, I guess, like, because I feel like, you know, when a writer like Don Patterson publishes a book of 40 sonnets or publishes like Rain that is entirely in traditional rhyming forms, I always feel like that's because he's got tired of like friends saying, oh, but Don, it's not really poetry, is it? It's not poetry. So it's like, well, fuck you. I'm going to write, here are 7,000 pantoums just to show you that I can do it. Now shut up. And it's like, I could do that, but I don't want to. Like, I'd rather just pursue the sort of form that actually calls to me, the one where I actually feel like there's the expansiveness to unfold the ideas and then fold them back in again. And so I just, yeah, I don't know. I think when I was in my 20s, I generally just was terribly worried about that sort of thing and be upset about people saying, oh, it's not really poetry. And now it's like, it's absolutely fine. Just, like, you know, engage with it in some way. And even if that's to kind of despise it, that's
well, on that subject of engaging with it, because that was another question I was going to put to both of you, was because both of your books have a sort of a source text behind them, and yet neither of them incorporate that source text into the work itself. I mean, so Luke, you have the first line of each sonnet before each poem, and Richard, you have sort of allusions to Wittgenstein's language, but it's as far as I remember, there are no sort of direct citations, although there are
actually about 15 lines. Okay. If anybody is interested, God help them, they can go to my website where there is a sort of citation list. But I that was a conscious choice not to put that in the book. I didn't want people distracted by that. It's not a scholarly text. It is a poem.
Well, this is a question about distraction. So when I was reading your book, Richard, I felt that I knew the Tractatus well enough from having studied it in the past that I didn't need to go back to it before engaging with your work. My knowledge of Shakespeare's sonnets, rather embarrassingly considering the bookshop that I work at, is much less than it was with the Tractatus. And I confess, Luke, I wasn't sure what might be the correct way to approach your work, whether I should familiarize myself with each sonnet before reading each poem or not. Now, I can imagine probably from both of you the response would be non-prescriptive. But I'm just curious to know if you've had any sort of different responses from readers about how they have engaged with the source text alongside your work or not, and how that's affected the reading or the understanding of the work.
Can I jump straight in here? Because this was something I was thinking about. Luke, I've been reading your book over the last week, and I really liked the approach of just having a single line at the top. I really liked, I felt if I thought should I go and read the sonnet, should I go and try and digest these, and actually no, I'd have got completely lost in it and it would have distracted from what you were doing. And no, it was lovely. It always reminded me, there's that a Christian technique of Lectio Divina where you just take a single line and you sort of chew it over in your mind and digest it, and so on. I loved that sort of way of each of your paragraphs as a kind of jumping off or a riff or just where your mind as a poet took you from these particular lines. No, I thought that worked absolutely superbly. With wherever, for what it's worth, I certainly tried to write a poem that could stand alone, and that what I was attempting to do was that somebody could pick this up who knew nothing about philosophy and read it as a love story, a war poem, all of those kind of traditional genres of English poetry, but also that somebody who was very engaged with Wittgenstein could read it and could get something. And one of the most terrifying gigs of my life about 2 months ago was speaking at the British Wittgenstein Society had a Tractatus centenary, and it was one of those ones where you slightly worry whether you're being set up. I got a very kind of invitation to come and read, and I thought, oh shit, am I just the straw man here? Am I the kind of the scapegoat in the sort of strict sense? But no, actually, it's talking to a room full of love. I was delighted with how happy they were to engage with this, how open they were to thinking about sort of the text as a poem, as a kind of aesthetic thing, and to bringing in his life. I know philosophers are sometimes very resistant to the idea that the life informs the work. I think in Wittgenstein's case, it's quite hard to sort of argue that. To go back to your question, no, I mean, readers, I've been really heartened that readers have generally got the point. They get the point that there are many different stories going on here, and you don't need a kind of tight knowledge of the philosophy to digest it.
And Luke?
That's good. Yeah, I've had a sort of split response in a way. So people who've mentioned to me that they read it almost as if it was just a weird novel, which I quite like. Mm-hmm. And it's because I guess it only really gathers any kind of narrative pace in the last sort of part or two where things feel a bit more sequential. Mm-hmm. But I do like that approach to it as well. And I like the way that the editor typeset it almost to sort of imply that. And the first lines thing was like absolutely came from him. We discussed various different formats with that. Actually, that looks really good. Mm-hmm. And then I've had like friends or acquaintances who sort of said that they absolutely read it in parallel with the sonnet in question and just read the sonnet first and then went to the prose poem to see if they could see what I was doing with it. Because sometimes it's a bit oblique. Like sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes I'm absolutely writing about, I don't know, the calendar act that came in, yes, sort of changes the date and shall I compare thee to a summer's day. And so sometimes
We should say to our listeners, the Darling Buds of May on July the 17th, is that a...
Yeah, yeah. I think I stretched that a little bit, so it was the same, so it became a Frank O'Hara reference, but it'd be sometime in June, basically, so it was more summary. But, so, at other times, it was literally like there'd just be a mention of a beach in one of the sonnets. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, okay, I can take that, and then I can try and get something else in from the sonnet into this, but I just want to write about this one weird little memory, and then see if I can bring it around, mm-hmm, to... the mood of the sonnet or what's going on there. And other times I get sort of just annoyed quite often, and especially in the early parts of the early sonnets, it numerically, whenever they were actually written, there's so much, I think I write about this really irritably in the book, there's so much of a focus on aging and absolute fixation on wrinkles, and that just, I think that's always kind of left me cold. Like we are all young precisely once, and we all have extremely different lives and various levels of hardship and injustice, some many more than others, but we are all young for the same amount of time. And I just felt like, get over it. Like, honestly, if you can't find yourself attractive or the people around you attractive, I mean, that's why you went, oh god, it just struck me as just such sort of shoddy thinking that has more in common with like Heat magazine taking photos of off-duty celebrities than with any sort of higher literary culture. And I was like, the sort of pettiness and the silliness of that, like let's write about that. Mm-hmm. What a weird thing to have in a love poem. Oh, you'll be old soon. you won't be as hot for about 15 years time. Ah, oh, what a tragedy that is. And it's like, that's awful. What shallow thinking. And that felt really worth getting irritated about. So sometimes just a certain kind of irritation just takes over and dominates our poem. So I've had people saying, oh, I can really see what you're doing in every one. And then I've had people say, several numbers, like, what were you even talking about there? Mm-hmm. How did that come from the original sonnet? And in most cases, I can just about still remember, mm-hmm, if I go back through. But again, I guess similar to Richard, I didn't want to provide a full set of notes on exactly what my thinking was in, because I felt like that would spoil it a little bit. Also, it feels like giving away the trick a little bit too much, and also like it makes it less porous, it closes things down, it stops people from being able to have their own relationship to it, to the original sonnets and to my prose poems. Because I want people to kind of feel like doing their own in some ways, or taking any other text and kind of writing into it in a similar way. I don't know.
And concerning your relationships with the text, has the process of writing these books changed your relationship? I mean, I had the sense, Richard, from what you said, that this has been sort of an enduring thing, something that was sort of sparked at 17 and you had to kind of almost get out of your system. Was the writing process and the sort of publication of this book, has that in some way got the Tractatus out of your system, or has it dragged you kind of deeper into it?
Yeah, what it's done actually is kicked me on to, I should say, Wittgenstein is notable in the history of philosophy for having a kind of a sort of early philosophy embodied in the Tractatus and a later philosophy, which is essentially a kind of repudiation of almost everything he said as a young man. And it's sort of, I've heard a number of philosophers say that when you're a young man, the Tractatus is much more appealing. It's sort of rigid and structured, and almost back to what Luke was saying about the kind of the appeals and the anxiety of formalism when you're younger. But as you get older, the older philosophy is a bit more battered and a bit more wise, and it's sort of happier. It's happier with uncertainty. It's happier with that sort of sense where we don't know we don't know where we're going. We don't know what we're doing. So it's got the Tractatus out of my system in that sense. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I've come in writing wherever I've sort of come to my own understanding of the Tractatus, whatever that may be. For what it's worth, it's embodied in wherever. And yeah, so I've sort of moved on, a kind of slightly sort of sadder and wiser man, to the older philosophy. But no, it's still something I've taken it down probably once a month since I published the book, just to look over it and sort of see it still there, and sort of see how it feels, if you know what I mean. Perhaps it's a pretentious thing to say, but it's like an old friend, you know. Mm-hmm. You sort of see them and you live with them, and you can't just put them aside.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And Luke, the sonnets. How I can only imagine that it was quite a. I don't know, when reading notes on the sonnets, it felt quite a sort of. What's quite the sort of an avoiding experience on your part? Like, it seemed that you sort of, you know, you said some of these are connected to real memories, others are pure invention, but it really felt that you were sort of excavating. A lot of your life and a lot of your thoughts. Have they become kind of attached now to the sonnets in your mind?
A little, yeah. No, there was definitely something purgative about the experience. But I think also just coming to the work so deliberately impertinently as well, and wanting to avoid doing something, you know, in a way that any redirection or restaging of a Shakespeare play does that, I guess. It's like, you know, there's a respect and a disrespect that comes in, but I think it sort of perversely made me sort of love them more as individual poems, and love some of the stranger cast off ones a bit more too. There's one poem in Eugene Onegin's in Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, where He just expresses his own disgust for his own project. Mm-hmm. It's just, I am so sick of this rhyme scheme that I've developed. I'm so sick of writing about this idiot, and I'm so sick of this whole form. And that moment of exhaustion, and that kind of comes up a few times in the 154 sonnets as well. It's just, what have I done? What path have I set myself on that now I can't seem to get off? Now I have to see this through now, and I have to kind of keep writing about this until I've got it all out of my system somehow, and I don't even want to do it anymore. I'm stuck with it, and I quite like that. I like that mood. I enjoyed finding those moments within Shakespeare's sonnets as well, sort of exploring it. But I sort of feel like I can read them just for themselves again now. So there were a couple of years where I was just working on this and just had this strange parasitic relationship to them, and now I feel like I can actually just go back to them and enjoy them.
One thing before we finish, Richard, just to sort of, and this is a slightly sort of oblique question, but it's really just to satisfy my curiosity, is that it seems obviously the Tractatus is the principal source text, but the second epigraph in the book is Russell Hoban's Pilgerman, and you also reference this as sort of an influence in your acknowledgement in your notes at the end. And I've read a few Hoban, obviously Ridley Walker and a couple of others, but I haven't read Pilgerman, and I'm just really intrigued as to the pertinence of this book to the evolution of your work.
I should say it's my favorite work of literature of the sort of second half of the 20th century. It is the most extraordinary novel. If you've read Ridley Walker, it's a sequel to Ridley Walker, but it's a thematic sequel. So it's not picking up those characters, it's picking up the ideas. Hoban wrote, I think he after he finished Ridley Walker, he had a heart attack and came reasonably close to dying. And he said that Pilgerman was the book where he made friends with death. It's set in a medieval world. It's set in a sort, as so much of his Hoban stuff is, it's set in almost a sort of magic realist world. It's a world of demons and ghosts and spirits and characters, but also very real human beings. And it picks up in some ways what is a very tired metaphor, which is life as pilgrimage towards death. And it's about the title character, Pilgrim in German, sets off to the Holy Land and has all kinds of adventures and experiences on the way. And the crucial fact is he doesn't reach Jerusalem. He's trying to, but he doesn't. And he encounters this party of children on the road. There's a whole story of the children's crusade, which is kind of horrifying in its own way. But he asks them, where are you going? And they say, we're going to Jerusalem. And he says, well, what if you don't reach it? And he says, well, Jerusalem will be wherever we are when we come to the end. And that struck me as a very Wittgensteinian thought. You know, it is perfectly possible that he might have met his end in the trenches of the First World War. And I think so much of his thought was this is where it gets so interesting to me, because it's not just technical philosophy about the structure of logic and language. It's about, how do we live? How do we face death? How do we deal with that prospect? How do you deal with it in a situation where you have deliberately put yourself mm-hmm. in the face of death and meaninglessness and tremendous suffering? I think Hoban's book is such a rich, deep exploration of that question. It's still, I think, the such a formative influence on me as a writer, but also as I say, in a kind of spiritual sort of way, in a text that really sort of gives you the space to grapple with these things for yourself. Mm-hmm. It's I've rambled enough about this book. It is magnificent, and it's already
moved to the top of my to read pile. That mm-hmm. sounds extraordinary. That is all we've got time for. Of course, wherever we are when we come to the end, and Notes on the Sonnets are both available from Shakespeare and Company, from our online store as well, or from your local neighbourhood independent bookstore, wherever that may be. All that remains for me to say is, Richard, Luke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ed.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. Since you've made it this far, I hope that means you've enjoyed what you've heard and will consider rating us in whatever app you're using. The theme music is Mr. Ginger by the incredible jazz musician Alex Fryman, taken from his album Play It Gentle. I'll be back next week. Until then, take care, happy reading, and thanks again for listening.